S-I-B-O-O, San Francisco, by my baby.
Shimma shimma. Shimma shimma. Shimma shimma.
Let me in.
Shimma shimma.
I want to be closer to you.
Shimma shimma.
Open up your soul.
Shimma shimma.
Let me find that part of you, the part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your mind.
Oh, why don't you let me in? Let me be the first to ever touch your mind.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. Today's show is entirely pre-recorded, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We are so lucky today because Tina D'Elia graced me with an interview, and I'm very excited about it. I get to finally see her in the virtual flesh. Welcome, Tina D'Elia.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. I'm so happy to be here with you.
So before we start talking about your upcoming show, when did you get bit by the performance bug?
Oh, gosh. Well, it definitely happened when I was a kid early on. So old movies, like we're talking about 4 and 5, like old movies and musicals and things like that. And my friend, stand-up comedian Natasha Muse, said that I baptized myself because 4-year-olds are not allowed to go up to the altar while my sister was being baptized in another room. And I went up to the altar myself and I performed to my invisible audience because I was raised Catholic. But then I'm not a Catholic, all good. So that's when I knew I was really engaging with this made up audience. And I thought, this is it. I'm performing, I'm speaking, I'm connecting. And then in the solo performance world, that definitely happened in the late 80s, early 90s, when performance art and spoken word poetry and all of that was coming about that I could see, you know, sort of on VHS. Very exciting.
Did you throw yourself headlong into performing as an adult? And do you remember what your first piece was that you look back and kind of go, you know, I was so young?
Oh my gosh, I love this question. Yes. So I would say, well, when I connected the dots between, I always enjoyed writing poetry as a kid and then being an actor. So I do remember performing like Alice in Wonderland. I went to an all-girls school. I remember I played Tom Sawyer. Like I remember playing these different parts, being the lead in Carousel and, you know, different performances like that in middle school. But then in college, when I went back to performance poetry, I performed it and I called it We Latina Women. And I was doing a lot of work ending sexual violence. I worked at a rape crisis center in the East Coast. So I came from the work in terms of it being like educational and bringing awareness. And so I took sort of We Latina Women and expanded it into different performances. And later I created a show about a judge. I played a judge who's sort of haunted by survivors whose cases are not heard. And I called that first solo show Forgotten Angel in 1995 in Boston. Wow. So when I think about it, I mean, I had an amazing director, Lois Roach, but that I think about, like, I was really new to what I was doing. Uh-huh. I didn't really want to look back at that first show just because I'm like, I think that I've been with the material for so long and I'm like, okay, I was learning. I'm grateful that I had a very good guide as a teacher, but I think that I was just still sort of green to everything I was doing. Then my next show, I really feel like I had much more roots in place because it was a story about this young Latina lesbian turning into Groucho Marx, and Groucho Marx is trying to come out to her family and it's very bananas. And I started that in Boston and then I brought it to San Francisco. So and I had a lot of different teachers. And so with the Groucho show, I feel like, okay, then I understood. I understood how I switch characters and how to keep kind of working on something and getting it tighter with the director and dramaturg. I'm hoping I answered your question. I
Yeah,
wasn't
you
sure.
did, but now you
Okay, good.
because I'm curious about the young Latina turning into Groucho Marx. Number one, how did you come up with it? And number two, what was it?
Yes, so it was twofold. One was my love for Groucho Marx and the Marx Brothers since I was a kid, because my parents were very interested in having a see theater and old movies, but were very much like, we should not have a television. We want the kids to read more. So I would end up watching much more about, I'd see much more of Katharine Hepburn and the Marx Brothers, and then eventually read about Groucho Marx. So I really related to that kind of comedy, the quick writing and thinking and screwball. So I was excited to study him as a character. And my first, there was a theater called the New Theater in Boston. And Rick DeRochet, the artistic director, was like, you talked about wanting to do a Groucho solo show. I'm interested in having you write out a synopsis. Maybe I could direct it. I love Groucho too. So it started there, which was great. That was around 96, 90, 1996, 1997. And then the second part of your question was
What was
Groucho
it
and the
about? Like,
Marxists. What was it about? Thank you. So one of my friends, Hannah, goes, that's great. So Groucho Marx wakes up and he's a Latina lesbian. And I wrote the opposite. I wrote, I think I remember she said that to me. I'm like, figuring out this show. And instead, I have that this character, Tina, which is different than me, is supposed to, her grandparents are flying in from Cali, Colombia. And we're going to meet at the Olive Garden. And her girlfriend, Helen, who looks not like Helen, but goes by Rodriguez, this butch Latina, who Groucho is not interested in. Groucho is interested in Tina's mother. Tina has so much anxiety about sort of coming out to the family and bringing Helen with her, Rodriguez, and how is it going to go? And through her anxiety, Groucho appears. So the more anxious she is and the more she's fighting to sort of be herself with her family and her mother being like, I don't know about Helen. Can Helen wear a dress? I'm like, no, Helen can't wear a dress. So suddenly the clothing appear and I look like Groucho and I sound like Groucho, but Tina's in there. So Tina and Groucho are fighting. Groucho hits on Tina's mother. Groucho's bonding with the grandparents. Groucho's singing songs. And Tina's like, you were okay. Thanks for helping me come out in the most interesting way possible by making a huge scene and singing Lydia, Lydia, from a chair in the restaurant, and we're almost getting kicked out. But then Tina needs to exercise Groucho out and just be seen and loved and respected as who she is, and her girlfriend respected too. So that was the premise.
Wow. Have you ever resurrected it? 'Cause that sounds amazing.
I had a long life with Groucho. My friend Michael LaRocco was my director. We even did a short little film that traveled around. It was just called Groucho, a short film, which was fun. And because I was with Groucho for so long, I put Groucho to rest
I get that.
around 2005, 2006. And I would still like pull out the outfit. I would from time to time sing a song. And then I just said, Groucho, I need to put you over here.
You
Why are
had to
you putting me over
exercise
there?
him.
He did. And what was great about Groucho Marx is now so many fictional characters come out of me, as many as possible. There is no doubt that Groucho Marx, since I was a small child, was an enormous influence in my life. There is no question about that.
That's
And
amazing. I used to like the Marx Brothers, but I was so sad as a child. I was sad because it was Harpo, because he couldn't talk. And I
right.
remember the day that I found out that he actually could talk. I was little and I was so happy. I almost cried because he was
Oh
my
my gosh,
favorite.
I love this story. That's great. Yes, I love Harpo.
So it sounds like from the get-go, as soon as you went off into the world, you were writing as well as acting in your own things. And it also sounds like you were doing one-woman shows from the beginning.
Yeah, like first it was performance poetry, and then it developed more and more, and then it became, yes, solo shows. I realized I was like, oh, this is my genre. This is sort of where I love to tell stories, connect with audiences. And the only historical pieces that are woven in are usually about, whether it's the icons from Overlooked Latinas or a bit about Groucho Marx's life or Rita Hayworth's life. But otherwise, I think it's more interesting to work in the genre of solo performance. And if anyone of your audiences knows what it's like to study with somebody like David Ford at the Marsh, there's so much to be said about all the people that we know and the characters that come out of us that have things to say. Lots of things to say.
Now, this is a question I like thinking about. Like, we all have been that young, exceptionally earnest, exceptionally like, this is important. And then you get some distance from it and you look back and you kind of point and laugh in that same way that you'll look at a hairstyle you had in high school and you'll think, what was I thinking? So, is there a performance from, way back where you go, oh, you were so young. What was I thinking?
Absolutely. I think that, well, first of all, I guess the benefit, I'm 56, so the benefit of working since I've been in my 20s as an actor, I feel one that the how much time I live in the characters, like I can tell when I look back at the work, I'm like, I needed to spend more time in those people. I was like, your physicality is a little, there's a little, it's not as sharp. The switching of characters to characters is not as sharp. I can remember. Do you remember the space called Lunacy in the Mission? I remember performing there. I remember doing Groucho and literally having a moment where I completely forgot where I was. And then what I always do is I rely on somebody. So Tina didn't rely on Tina. I relied on Groucho Marx and he found me there. He just said, we're going over here. And then I'll wink at the audience. And then I'll talk over there. And then eventually I'll find it. And that usually barely ever happens just because I have a different way of approaching the work. It's like you do it 117 times. And most of the mistakes is more about kind of flubbing the line, having a stumble, but it's usually not going, I don't know where I am. That to me is sort of like, I'm like,
Every actor's worst nightmare.
worst nightmare. And that's the video. I'm like, I don't want you to see that video. Like, I'd love to see a piece of your work. Yes. How about something recent?
Got it.
Yeah.
Speaking of something recent,
Yes.
you've got a new show coming out. Let's talk
I
about
do.
that.
Yes. The breakup, a queer Latina torch song.
Okay. Is this based on a real breakup or is it just a flight of fancy?
I feel like it's all in between. It's a flight of fancy, and then it's a collection of breakups. And I feel like it's both my real breakups and then my character's fictional breakups. Since eventually the protagonist goes to a breakup support group, other people have to share their breakups too. Even a breakup with a friend. But what was different than I even thought when I was working on the breakup show is I had an idea for it in 2017, 2018, where the character goes to the breakup support group and meets people like Just Joyful or Soon to Be Happy. Or Popo, that would be the protagonist, Trina. So I think she's a little bit like, what's this place? I'm here. Like, there's no address. It's somewhere on a hill. I just need help. I was like, why? Okay, I don't want to judge about your names. So I worked on it for a while, and then I got a grant, and then I was off to the races, and then we had COVID. And in COVID, I started doing these long walks. So the 80s music became very much a theme. I started digging through like my life in the 80s and when I was bullied, and then when I first fell in love, and then when I realized like I was making all these connections. I'm like, my first girlfriend. Then I realized that my first girlfriend, the bully of the past, had a crush on my first girlfriend, and my first girlfriend thought he was a total loser. It was the best like rom-com story. I had never, I didn't cast it, I didn't write it, it just happened. And no matter what I was uncovering, I was like, whether this is in the show or not, it helped me go much deeper because I was like, I need to keep figuring out what every time I had a breakup, like what was going on, what were all the dynamics, what was the friends, the family. And then I had a theme. How many people had a set of cats and two cats? Do they share cats? Do they have cats? Do they have other cats? Do they have dogs? Which is why the cats do make an appearance, two of them. That's why the protagonist dates somebody who has two cats. I don't have anything against cats per se. So yeah, so both through my real life and then also the flight of fancy of other characters I created, we explore breakups.
So you said you had this idea back in 2017. So you've been cooking this or baking this for a long time
Yeah.
while you simultaneously have these other shows that
That's
you've
right.
written. So it seems like when you think about people writing, you think about them writing this and then this and then this, but it sounds like you have them going on simultaneously.
Yeah, that's a great question. So what helped is I would put it down when I would be getting ready for another show. And
Mm-hmm.
then I would come back, and sort of my process is go into David Ford's class for 10 weeks, my dramaturg, development person through the Marsh, who's wonderful, and work on it for a while, do some kind of workshop, take a break, totally stop, go do my other projects, come back, which usually always means it will be better. I've had time, I've let it marinate, and I'm still figuring out, is this the story I want to tell? And then, which was great, because I feel like that got to happen a couple times. So my first iteration was a workshop, and it was and the Brava Theater was handling all the tech because it was remote, because it was 2021. So then after that, I thought, that's a good show, but that's not quite the show yet. So it was the first time in my life where I am, and I've worked this whole time with my director, Mary Guzman, who's wonderful. And this was the first time in my life where I ever performed a workshop of my show remote before it went to the stage.
And that had to have, because it was hard. We've all managed to block that time out of our memories. But I remember, trying to watch theater on, it was tough. It had to be tough on the artists because you can only focus on like a few people at a time. And the technology was always screwy and it was just so unsatisfying. So I applaud you for getting through that.
Thank you. So part of the pausing in that development was going, oh, okay, so now I get to come back to the show, start working on it in class, on the stage, and figure out what is the story I want to tell now on the stage, and how do I want to develop that? And it was exciting because the Marsh had their first In Front of Your Eyes Festival for women and non-binary folks in August of 2024. And I was able to, it didn't have to be finished pieces, but that I feel like that got to be my first step of being like, okay, now this is the new show in process, which was very exciting. And it was really different than the remote piece. And what I've learned every time I go perform at Theater Rhinoceros, anything I worked at before, whether it was Overlook Latinos or the Reader Show, everything always gets better and it always is different because usually also as a solo performer, I'm in a black box and Theater Rhinoceros will create a design and a set and colors and wardrobe and there's a bit more involved. So this time around doing the breakup show, there's new things I've never utilized before. I was like, oh, we could have a few gags, we could have a few things. We may not only see cats, we might see some hedgehogs. There may be some donuts, there may be some fortune cookies. There's some new things along the way. But
Well, if you put
so
donuts
I
in the show, you got to share them with the audience.
okay. Noted. Noted.
Thank you. So you're doing it at Theater Rhino.
Yes, so excited.
I'm excited for you. So when does the show open?
November 6th is preview, and it goes through the 23rd, and the opening night is Saturday, November 8th at 8 o'clock.
Okay.
Yay.
And again, it's a one person show.
One person show.
Except you probably have like, a lighting person or whatever, but it's a one person show. I gotta give it up for you because I've had nightmares where I've been on stage and forgotten what I'm supposed to do. And in my mind, in the dream, I'm like, well, I'll just play off the lines of the other person. You don't have another person. But then at the same time, it's your show. So if you flub a line, no one will know except for you.
That's right. That's right. So I feel like the biggest save is always to whoever's talking, and whoever I'm going to, I just have to figure out who's going to save who. Right. Like which character is going to save which character. And if I'm confused, then they'll be confused and then they'll figure it out.
Well, once again, for our listening audience, when and where for the breakup show?
Yes, Theater Rhinoceros in the Castro, November 6th to 23rd.
And Theater Rhinoceros, for those of you who don't know, it's on 18th Street between, I want to say, Collingwood and Diamond. It's next to the Molly Stone. I know because I walk by it every single day.
Yay.
And if people want to find out more about what you're doing, how do they low-key stalk you online?
Yes, they can locate talk me at tinadelia.com.
And how do you spell that?
TINADELIA.com.
And with that, Tina and Dalia, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you so much, Marilyn. I had so much fun. Yay.
Yay! Listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. Who's about to touch your mind right now? Well, we've all heard the dulcet tones of Karen Carpenter. And in fact, she has a range that is as lovely and soothing and a number of songs that back in the day, we all knew all the words to. And there is someone who was going to be channeling the lovely and incandescent Karen Carpenter. I'd like to welcome Lori Roldan. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you.
So let's travel back in time to when did you first start singing? And then when did you first decide that Karen Carpenter was the woman you wanted to channel?
Well, I started singing when I was like 3 years old at my parents' house in Moraga, California. And I learned to sing to Karen Carpenter's music. Oh. And I would lay by the stereo on my parents' 1970s, you know, shag rug there in Moraga. And I would just listen. She was just really the first singer that I really was listened to. And I learned to sing by just copying, you know, just singing over and over again to all her songs. And she really, I just felt a connection with her. I just knew all the words and I learned to sing to her, and it was just had a real big impact on me. My dad was a clarinet player and we had all kinds of, you know, the 60s and 70s music. I loved Mamas and the Papas. I loved all the folk music and stuff, but Karen Carpenter touched my heart and I just had this connection with her. And that's how it all started when I was like 3 and 4 years old.
So do you personally, or is this just family folklore? Do you remember being that young and singing along to the music?
Yeah, I do. I can see it now. I remember, you know, I do. I remember it. And also, my mom used to exercise to the Carpenter song, The Top of the World. And she know how, remember Jazzercise and like, I don't know, it was an exercise routine she had. And I used to just dance along with her and to that song. So I have, you know, memories, very, very distinct memories of that song in particular with my mother and feeling close to my mom. And that just seemed to sort of bring me closer to Karen too.
I gotta say, it would be just so adorable to come across a three-year-old singing all the words to a Karen
yes.
Carpenter's.
Oh.
Like, did you actually know the words or were there, because they're concepts and songs that you did.
I did. You know what? I don't know. Like I said, this is why I feel so strongly about, you know, my show and my connection with Karen. You know, I never met her or anything, but I just had this connection. It's funny, her mom's birthday is the same day as my mom's birthday.
Okay.
And she just had that soothing quality to me. And maybe I just felt drawn to her. And so I did. I mean, I was, you know, I started singing when I was 3 and 4, but when I was 7, 8, 9, especially, you know, I knew all the words. That's kind of when I knew, you know, I wanted to be a singer. I knew that's really what my passion was. Mm-hmm. So I could memorize the songs really easily.
So at what point do you start singing, or when was the first time you sang where you thought, I'm officially a singer? And then when was the first time you sang Karen Carpenter for an audience?
That's actually a really good question. Okay. I always knew that I loved to sing, but I think I think it was my middle school talent show when I had my guitar and I sang for that. That's kind of when I was like, this is my passion. This is what I love to do, playing my guitar and singing. And with Karen, What was the second part of the question again? You
Well, the first part was, when was your first time where you felt like you were like a professional singer?
Yes.
And then when was the
Oh.
first time you did Karen Carpenter in front of an audience as a professional singer?
Well, as a professional, actually, I did not sing her music. I mean, maybe I did some in high school. I did, choir, I did theater, I did all of that. But I don't, honestly, I was, when I was, besides Karen, growing up, then of course I went into my high school years in the 80s and 90s music, and I sang, Pat Benatar, and I sang all that kind of music for a while. But as far as doing like the Carpenters seriously, as it's kind of like that was my first love and my first way, the first how I learned to sing. So doing professionally and doing this cabaret was not until 8 years ago. I mean, I was inspired by, I mean, I probably have sung the songs, but I have never done, I did theater, I did cabaret, but never with the Carpenters music. So I'm sure I did sing their songs here and there. Like I did sing We've Only Just Begun at weddings here and there. That's, but as far as me doing this is a unique show that came, it was literally, I think, God inspired in a lot of ways. It came when my daughters were auditioning for college and they were going out, and I felt that time in my life when I was going to be an empty nester, and what did I want to still contribute after doing theater and, some light opera, after doing inspirational. And then my voice teacher said, well, who was your biggest inspirations of music growing up? And that's when I started reflecting. And I had had people tell me during shows, like in Godspell, when I did Godspell, I had a reviewer say, oh, she sounds similar to Karen Carpenter when she sings. So during my life, even doing other shows, I would have reviewers and people tell me this. And so that's kind of, it just sort of came together that way. And then when my vocal coach had suggested I do a one-woman show or a cabaret, I really thought, okay, Karen Carpenter was my biggest inspiration. And so I just dove deep into that because it was a time in my life, like I said, when I really wanted to really do something else. I always felt that I was going to do something more, something bigger. And it's part of like my legacy for my own daughters. And also just because of a lot of ups and downs, like we all have in the arts, with music. I have three kids, I took time off for a while and I got back into my career, and watching them flourish kind of inspired me to go into my next part of my life in my 50s doing this. So I created this as an inspiration for people because I took it, I took after many, many read-throughs and many ideas about the Carpenters music and what I was going to do. At first it was going to be a Carpenter song, and then maybe I would do an opposite, like uplifting, different inspirational song at first. But then I thought, no, the Carpenters music tells a story, and it really tells all of our stories, right? All of the songs everyone relates to. But in particular, for me, I decided to have it be my life story through Karen's music because, and it completely flowed from then. And so I also bookend the show with a song for you. And so that's how it started flowing. And I debuted my show in 2021. I was ready in 2020, but then we all know what happened there. So,
COVID derailed a lot of
yeah.
people. So when you told your parents 7 or 8 years ago you're going to do Karen Carpenter, did they just start regaling you with
Yeah.
stories of your childhood?
Yeah, my mom had told me, actually my dad passed away in 2007. So unfortunately he wasn't able to see this part of my life, but I know he would be really, happy about it and really
Tickled.
supportive because he was the musician like in our family. But my mom started remembering, like she would say, oh yeah, I remember, we listened to all that all the time. You never wanted to stop listening to it. That was always going, that music. So yeah, it was pretty cool. She's been to most all of my shows, so it's really awesome.
Aww, she your
Yeah.
biggest cheerleader?
And my daughters too. My daughters are in the show actually too, which is wonderful.
Wow.
Yes.
Family that wants to spend time with you. That's such a rarity.
Yeah, limited time. They're in their 20s, so yeah.
So what's the show called?
It's called A Song for You, The Music of Karen Carpenter.
And you say you're telling your life story through the music. So how do you start your life, Karen Carpenter-wise?
Yes, I start my life Karen Carpenter-wise with A Song for You. That's sort of, I kind of got inspired when I saw the musical Beautiful, because I went to see that, and they bookended it with you know, Carole King starting on the piano, and then it ends on the piano. And I just liked the idea of starting and then ending it kind of, it's sort of haunting, sort of, you know, I just like that. And the other reason is I wanted people to know I am singing this song, my song for you. If I can inspire you, that's what my purpose is in my show, is to inspire you to never give up on your purpose, because my purpose is singing. And I have, when you see my show, hopefully you can see it, I go through my life, and there's a lot of times when I wasn't singing and I should have been. You know, I took detours, I made mistakes, I wasn't confident, you know, all the stuff that a lot of people go through. But I, after having friends tell me you need to tell your story, I, you know, decided to do that. So I start that, and then I sing Yesterday once more. I take people back to yesterday, and I don't want to tell too much, because then, you know, people need to come see it. But sure. Then I take them on a little journey of my life. And I think, as what the feedback that I've had too, is, you know, it really takes everyone on a journey. You know, it takes everyone on that cathartic journey of listening to this music and remembering the moments where they were and these times.
So when you are listening to the Carpenters, which song for you captures sort of the depths of despair, and which song can you listen to and will always cheer you up?
I love that question. That's such a good question. Okay. Depths of despair would be Hurting Each Other and Goodbye to Love. That's kind of a point in my show, pivotal point, Goodbye to Love, Hurting Each Other. And then here, the song that is the cheer up song besides Top of the World would be the song Sing.
We all
need to sing our song. And I am strongly, that's the biggest encouraging thing. Sing out loud, sing out strong. Don't worry that it's not good enough for anyone else to hear. Do what you were made to do in your purpose.
I love that. I think my favorite Carpenter song is Only Yesterday. It has an emotional resonance that makes me cry, but it's such a sweet song.
That's another pivotal moment in my whole story. When I do the show in two acts, and I also do it in one act but when I do it in two acts, my intermission is at Only Yesterday. That was a pivotal point in my life, actually. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's definitely a very emotional and, you know, important song in my show.
Well, now that the listening audience has heard about the show, when and where?
Yay! Okay. I want everyone to come see the show with my amazing musical director, Michael Hatfield, and my wonderful singers. I feature my singers in my show. I've got Chris Aceves, I've got Joy Sherritt, and I have Clarice Nicole. And then I have the wonderful Michael Henning on drums and Aaron Germain on bass at Feinstein's at the Nico, November 1st. And I cannot wait. So it's going to be Saturday night, November 1st, 8 p.m. Doors open at 7. And tickets can be purchased online at Feinstein's dot, I think it's .com. Feinstein's. You can, Feinstein's SF, Feinstein's San Francisco. You can go right. All the shows are there. And yeah. And also on my own Instagram and website, LoriRoldan.com, people can buy tickets there as well.
Excellent. Excellent. So one more time for our listening audience, when and where for
November 1st at 8 p.m. Feinstein's at the Nico in San Francisco. And they can get tickets at Feinstein's.com, you know, at Feinstein's website or my website, LoriRoldan.com. And I'm also going to New York and singing at 54 Below in New York City. But I know that's, you know, for my audiences here, come to the city. If you're in New York, 54 Below on November 11th. And then my daughter's in that show there. She's a New Yorker.
And what is the name of the show again?
A Song for You, the music of Karen Carpenter. It's my passion to uplift and inspire everyone to pursue
Excellent.
Their passion.
We're just about out of time. So is there anyone you want to shout out to?
Oh my gosh. Well, I want to say thank you to Eric at Feinstein's and my wonderful team that's going to be there singing, you know, my great musicians. I named them, all of them are just, and of course, and my family, and then my daughter too, who's going to be in my show in New York, and my husband, who's just my total support. So I'm so grateful. My family, my husband, you know, thank you. And thank you, Marilyn, for having me today. I'm so grateful to be able to share this with folks. So don't miss it. You're gonna love it, and you're gonna be inspired and uplifted.
All right. Well, Lori Roldan, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much for having me. Have a great day.
bless the beasts and the children, for in this world they have no voice, they have no choice. Bless the beasts and the children, for the world can never be.
It's that time of the month. It's the last Monday of the month. As you all know, I love to have my librarianistas on. I have two today, so it's double your pleasure, double your fun. So I'd like to welcome Emily Vanderhorn and Adrian Story. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
So before we get started about what's happening in this upcoming month, why don't you each tell me what part of the library you work in? So we're going to start with Emily.
I'm head of preservation for the San Francisco Public Library and City Archives, and I work off-site, and we take care of all of the library materials, branch materials, main materials, and City Archives, ensure that everything's in great shape for patrons to view.
And how about you, Adrian?
Yes, well, my title is City Archivist, and so I manage the San Francisco History Center on the sixth floor of the main library, and we also have a Book Arts and Special Collections Center. So it's all together. It's our archives and special collections for San Francisco Public. And we are the official repository for the archives of the city and of San Francisco. So one of the special things about our collections is that we have both the government perspective and community perspective for San Francisco history.
Ooh, I want to follow up on that. Let me put a pin in that. But my first question for the both of you is, given how the delivery of information has changed, how do you know what to archive? Because there's simultaneously so much out there, but so much drivel out there.
Yeah, I can take that. You know, scope is really important. And so we are in the process of re-refining our scope. You know, over time, we have to re-refine our scope to really think about what is missing in our collections. That's a big that's a big emphasis, like whose stories have been privileged in the historic record, whose stories have been suppressed or erased, and what role do we play in bridging those gaps? And that could be by filling those holes in our collections. It can also be by supporting communities that are documenting themselves, if that is the preference, to not have it in a major repository. So there's a full spectrum of how we can support that. But that is definitely an emphasis of collecting in this day and age and across all formats, whether it's, you know, physical materials or digital materials. We're really looking at a balance of historical representation and perspective.
Then given that the digital materials, that the delivery systems keep changing and going obsolete, how do you manage that aspect of it? Because I have floppy disks from 1990 or something. You know, if you were to show it to anyone today, they'd go, is that an earring? So how do you manage saving information in a format that keeps going obsolete?
It makes things challenging, for sure. And right now we're just on the beginning phases of developing our digital archives program. But one of those pieces is, for example, having specialized workstation that can read all of those kinds of formats. Mm. Of course, you may run into problems with, for example, software. I know that when I was in college, I used WordPerfect. It's really hard to open a WordPerfect file these days. So there are some limitations, but there's also specialized tools that are developed within the archives community, a lot of open source tools that allow for looking at files of all types. So it's, and it's hard to catch up to that education, right? So it's a lot about continuing to learn on the job. I think it's very exciting. Again, we're in the beginning stages of it. So, you know, we took Mayor Breed's records when she departed office, and they were on a hard drive. The bulk of that material was on a hard drive. So we've stabilized those files onto our storage as we have it now. But we're just really starting to collect more digital materials now.
Emily, what does your typical day look like in terms of archiving?
So we don't do archiving work. We are conservators. So we rely on the librarians to decide what's important enough to keep and what materials are damaged and need work before patrons can safely handle and access them. Mm-hmm. And that's what then comes across our workbenches. So a typical day is a lot of hands-on book repair, photo repair, blueprint repair, map repair, in addition to making sure that larger programs like environmental monitoring, pest monitoring are all in place and being checked regularly.
Oh, pest monitoring.
We live in a lovely environment. It's warm, it's comfortable for humans and for all kinds of critters, unfortunately, as well.
That would freak me out, honestly, to be honest. In a typical day, how does the public interact with your departments?
Do you want to take that, Emily, first?
So yeah, I can start off with that. We in preservation are in collections and technical services, which is a building that's actually closed off to the public. So we don't interface on a day-to-day basis. Our completed projects interface with the public when they're able to safely access and view and flip through them. But we do a fair bit of public outreach, which involves having a fairly active social media presence through the library Instagram accounts, as well as public programming about preserving your collections, answering patron questions should they be directed to us.
So what kinds of requests do you get typically?
A lot of it, since we are from the library, is book and photograph related, but we do have occasional patrons who come in. They maybe inherit a really sentimental cookbook from their great-grandmother that's falling apart and has notes all across the margins. Uh-huh. And they're looking for advice on how can I handle this? How can I save this?
So it's not simply that it's the things that you have. You also give advice to just a layperson on how to keep the things that they want to that they cherish.
We're doing more and more public outreach, and San Francisco has such a rich history. There are a lot of personal collections and archives that we are really invested in helping people preserve, as well as the formal library collection.
I think that's a shared goal of our departments because the historic record relies on so, private, community, public record, all, all kinds of collections, whether they're personal or public. And our department serves the public more directly with all the open hours of the library. We have a reference desk that we have librarians on staff 7 days a week that are answering in-person patron reference requests. And then we also do a ton of email reference, phone reference, et cetera.
So what are some of the categories of materials that you archive? For example, I remember I was in the library a while back and you guys were doing a thing about the pandemic of 1918 in San Francisco. Is that something, do you categorize the news from that? Or, and what other things do you, what all do you archive?
What do we collect? So, yeah. I mean, there's the city records component. So we will work with city departments to collect their records of what we call enduring value, anything that really tells a story about how decisions were made or what happened, how our government was run at different times in history. Mm-hmm. But for community collections, it is, anything from, we call them manuscript collections. It's, people's writings, correspondence, photographs. We have like 2.5 million photographs in our photograph collection. So there's a wide range. There's a lot of audiovisual materials in our collection. So it's just any format. It's really, the focus is on the informational content more than the format. So just anything that has the, gives a perspective or provides information about an aspect of history.
Okay. Now you mentioned you have materials from the government point of view and you have materials from the community point of view. How do you determine? It's easy to figure out with government because they have all these written records, but how do you figure out where the information is for the community?
A lot of our collecting has been throughout over time has been people proposing to donate to us. Mm. One of the things we want to, what we looking forward to do is having a bit more of a proactive approach to, and there certainly has been both along the way. So sometimes in archivists, a lot of times this may take many years of being aware of something that is a community group, for example, that might be really active in a movement or just making an impact in San Francisco. So an archivist might notice that and build relationship and ask about, how are they looking to preserve their history and either support, support whatever is the goal of that organization. And one option would be to have that come to our repository. So that's one way, but certainly over the years we get so many offers to of donations to mm-hmm. our collections because people say they self-nominate as like we want this preserved and we want it preserved locally, so we get that as well.
Now I want to ask each of you, and I'm going to start with Emily, because you're archivist and I'm guessing that you're probably poring over some of it, what is your favorite or most intriguing thing that's come across your desk that you, as an archivist, were really interested in knowing about or maybe didn't know about until it came across your desk, starting with Emily?
Ooh, one of my recent highlights would be working on materials from the McLaren Collection, the designer of Golden Gate Park. We have all of his original manuscripts and personal book collection that helped shape what is Golden Gate Park, right down to plant lists, books about nothing but apple trees, etc., including a diary that he kept when he traveled around the world with his wife, visiting famous gardens across the world to gain inspiration and ideas for Golden Gate Park. And that's just a wonderful combination, travel diary, and you can really see the beginnings of Golden Gate Park start to take shape in his own words.
Did he ever express frustration from time to time, or was it all head into the foray?
Well, the vacation portion of it, the manuscript itself, is all quite rosy and cafes in Paris, dress fittings for his wife kind of thing. The actual building, I haven't dug into those materials yet, but I'm sure there is a never-ending source of frustration about building limitations, etc.
I love it because you never really think about Golden Gate Park as someone had to build it because it's always been there. How about you, Adrienne? What's something that you've
One of my highlights is just seeing it, seeing those really early stages, the inspiration, the materials that went into it.
And you, Adrienne, what's something that intrigued you in your archiving explorations?
Well, I'll admit that I've been in my role for years, so I'm really still learning our collections. There's amazing material in them, and I don't work as directly with individual items because I'm more of the like managing our systems and all that, like the back end of things. But I have there's amazing material in our collections. What comes to mind at this moment is that I did that I hadn't been exposed to in my past as an archivist is just the these large bound volumes that the city used to store records. So they're just these large ledgers, a lot of handwritten ledgers, and those are just really interesting as a record keeping method. And they're a little mysterious. It's hard to figure out exactly how they're organized. There's a lot of cryptic systems of how they're organized. So we've had one of our people on our team has done a deep dive with those. So that's been an interesting process. But there, I mean, everything that I come in contact with has a pretty impactful, mind-blowing sort of, effect. And it makes me so motivated to do this work and to do the more back-end stuff that I work on is all really ultimately about connecting people with these amazing materials.
So I want our listening audience to know if they want to interact with the archivists or if they have any questions about it, how would they go about doing that? Or even
Well,
looking at the records?
For the archives and special collections, people are welcome to come in all of the open hours of the library, the main library. And also we have a email, sfhistory@sfpl.org. That is where people can email reference questions. And yeah, I'd say those are the two best ways to go about it.
And similarly, preservation unit at sfpl.org. We monitor our email and can help with any specific conservation questions, concerns. And I would love to take the opportunity to do a little plug for our Ask a Conservator Day, which is coming up on November 4th. In the afternoon, we are hosting seven local Bay Area conservators across all specialties who are going to be available to the public to assess items, talk about the materials, handling needs, storage, display, possible conservation, etc.
When is that and where?
So it is on Tuesday, the 4th of November, from 3 to 7 o'clock at the main library.
And do you need to register in advance or can you just show up?
We recommend registering in advance. There will be some walk-in time slots available, but it can't be guaranteed. We have a splash page. If you look up SFPL Ask a Conservator Day, you will be directed to booking links as well as more event information.
I love that concept of ask a conservator. Is this your first time doing that program?
It's the first time we're doing it in person. We've done so just over social media in the past, but it's the first time that patrons can actually bring their physical objects in for an assessment.
Oh, okay. All right. That sounds great. And after a ask a conservator, what other events do you guys have on the books?
So 6 months from now, we'll have another conservation clinic, which will be an in-person discussion about how to handle your artwork, basic collections care, what kind of boxes and materials you should avoid, what you should be using, and a more overarching general collections care for your personal collections.
So we have ask a conservator, and then in 6 months you can find out how to take care of your own personal things. And if people wanted to just kind of figure it out, because they're big readers, because they love the library, are there any books or websites or anything like that that you would recommend for people who are trying to be their own personal archivist?
I think of the Library of Congress has some really good outline tools, but of for personal collections, et cetera. There's also a really great resource called the Sustainable Heritage Network that has a lot of videos and how-tos for people to peruse. What comes to mind for you, Emily?
So definitely the American Institute of Conservation website has very robust sections on how to handle everything from furniture through to postage stamps, and is a great resource for people who have questions about just how best to manage their materials.
Excellent, excellent. Well, ladies, librarianistas, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. You mentioned the Library of Congress. I'm going to give a big shout out to the San Francisco Public Library, because I went to DC. I went to the Library of Congress on the weekend. It was closed. I was stunned. The San Francisco Public Library is open practically every single day. So we win. So I want to thank you guys both for being on the show. Emily and Adrian, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.